Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from the Best American Short Stories from the year 2021, edited by Jessamyn Ward. Good Boy by Elagosa Asunda. I've always had a problem with introductions. To me, they don't matter. It's either you know me or you don't. You get? If you don't, the main thing you need to know is that I'm a hustler through and through. I'm that guy that gets shit done. Simple. Kick me out of the house at 15, a barge-in on secret behind me, a heartbreak falling into my shin as I walk, and watch me grow some real useful muscles. Watch me learn how to play all the necessary games, good and ungood. Watch me learn how to notice red eyes, how to figure out when to squat and bite the road's shoulder with all my might. Watch me learn why a good knife, and not just any type of good, but the moral-less kind, the father-like kind, is necessary when you're sleeping under a bridge. Just a week after that, watch me swear on my own destiny and insist to the God who made me that I'm bigger than that lesson now. Then watch my aura align. Watch me walk from that cursed bridge a free man and learn how to really make money between age damaged and age 22. Watch me pay the streets that I owe in blood and notes, up front, no installments. Watch me never lack where to sleep again. Second thing to know about me, I know how to make the crucial handshakes. Third thing, I know they make the same mistake twice. Almost evict me from my place in Cirillera at age X and watch rage stab me forward. Watch how in 3 weeks I treat my own fuck-up with not just a room but an apartment 4 times as big as Bagada. The how is irrelevant. Fourth thing, I'm serious about being alive. Because of this, there's nothing I can't survive. Anybody who knows me knows that. The rest na breeze. It is my God-given right to be here. This life? Me. I must chop 'em. And it must be on my own terms. What makes all this worth it otherwise? Nothing. Someone I know joked just 2 days ago, Seth, that even if I end up in hell at the end of the day, I won't stop kicking. I won't stop reaching for something. I will insist on my space. In reality, I'm not the kind of guy who ends up in a place like that because, fifth thing, I'm not the kind of guy who believes in hell or in a god who imagines a lake of fire. I just can't see it. You have a mind that's wider than the sky, and that is what you use to picture? To me, that sounds too petty, too human, too undivine to be real. People sell all kinds of gods all the time. I know the one that moves me, and it's not the one I was raised on. To me, you can't say your love, choose to roast people for eternity, and then pretend it breaks your heart. Pick a side. Anyhow, the guy said the hell thing to make a point, and it's true. Luck finds my head, business competes with my blood on who keeps me best, and either might fail depending on the day. So now I always wonder, what do people want to use my name for? It will not buy you anything. Name drop me and they'll still redirect you to me. In that sense, it's irrelevant to know. I answer a first name only, and it's for the people I know. But my story? Ah, damn. Now that many people can do a whole lot with. Start here. I'm not inspiring. When I first moved to Lagos, I didn't come here with good mind. I came here with one mission and one mission only, to get a lot of money so as to prove my popsy wrong. That's all. For me, blood family doesn't mean shit. Family is your spine dividing into 4, hot metal in your back, red life shooting out of you in a geyser. It's you falling forward in slow motion, a yelp in your neck, whole outfit ruined in the air. You, reading this, you're here, alive, because your parents sinked and you showed up. That's it. Even if they planned for a child, it was still a raffle draw. A hand went in a bowl and picked you. The tree shook and a fruit fell down. If it pains you to read, then cry. It's deeper for your mum because she probably pushed so hard her body gasped, only for your ungrateful head to come out of it. But your father? Half the time all he did was grunt and drop some bands. And on the way to where I am, what I learned is that anybody with money can drop money. And most men, can drop money. Even poor men. That's something I wish my mother had known so she wouldn't have, but at least did herself into the ground. Money loves circles and men run in circles, stinking, adrenaline pumping. Money hardly goes to lone dots unless you threaten it. And even then, believe me when I tell you, it probably took a 100-person team to execute that threat, most of them unnamed. The face of a thing is not the body of it. Even women with serious money, few and far between dots, have to pretend they don't have. There's a reason, you know. It's in the code. It'll take a new world for that to stop being true. Men with small money will still impress each other over beer. Men with medium money will find ways to barter. And men with large money will slice this country like cake if they get sad enough, bored enough. Dropping money is all tied to pride, and they taught us that we need pride. So for many of us, that act alone, of rescuing someone, of fulfilling a duty, of settling a debt, pumps blood somewhere specific. When I lost home, my goal was simple. All those insults that my father used to be casual about, I wanted to erase them. I wanted to outdo him so that when people called our family name, there would be more to say about me than about the man who picked me up as a boy and stretched me into a man in the space of an afternoon. I was on the streets so fast it felt like I dreamed those memories of the man reading a newspaper, the head of the house watching the news, the father petting the kiboko like something safe. He beat the sound out of all of them. So those days when I used to play my mind back wondering if things could have been different, I meet more bite than bark. But he hardly talked anyway except to say things like, "You won't amount to anything." So it's not like I was missing much. He was furious a lot, which makes sense. People are like that when they hate themselves. He was wrong about what he said, though. Embarrassingly wrong. What I've amounted to can buy who he was at least twice. My father was a well-educated man, a man who had a should-be-so for everything. The table should be set so. All family members should be at home by 7 p.m. Breakfast should always include eggs. A wife should be this way. A husband should be that. Dutiful, he never excused himself from his own hand. The one time he was unable to pay our school fees and our mother offered, the house did a headstand and blood rushed into our brains, I swear. We sat at home that term. That's what should can do. About me, he believed I should be grateful. He still chose to raise me, having noticed my softness from early. He believed I owed him something and feared that if I didn't love the way he prescribed for me, I'd ruin my life. Funny, because his love tied his hands often. His love made an army out of us. That day, when he walked in on me and my classmate, I saw him fight himself to the ground. What followed was what he thought he had to do. He questioned every feeling, tested it for fitness. If he didn't think it would suit a man his size, he'd treat it like a son, send it away with its head bowed. Rage was good. Rage was a feeling with a hard core and some biceps. So, a beautiful rainfall of blows. What kind of weak father would have no problem with what he saw? What kind of weak man would see such a thing and let his son go free? "Look at yourself," he kept saying, staring me down. "Look at yourself. You've destroyed the family name." I dropped the family name after 4 years away. They can keep it. It stopped meaning anything to me. Any weight put on my name since then comes straight to me. Is for me. Just me. He used to say, "It's as you make your bed that you lie in it." I sleep in a made bed every night, king size. It's someone else's job to make it. He also loved to say, any man who comes back home after 7 p.m. is a thief. Some days I leave home to work at 7 p.m. because I can. Not me get my life. I'm many things, but a thief is not one of them. The easiest way to put what I do in context is to quote Jay-Z, "I'm not a businessman, I'm a business man." Everywhere you look around you, there are gaps in markets. I see them and fill them. That's what I do. I did some shady things in my earlier days, I can't front, but those ones are not for the books. When Popsy first kicked me out, I went to my uncle's house, a pastor, and he housed me. I don't discuss those years for good reason. Let's just put it like this. Everything that was holy in me left me there. Nah, there my eye first tear. So when I left, I worked with churches, supplying actors for dramatic miracles. I trained them from experience, taught them how to faint, how to roll their eyes into their heads, when and through where exactly the spirit should flee. Pastors rushed it. Me and my guys got our first place in Opebi with the money we made. We paid 2 years' rent, cash down. I'm sure the landlord thought we were Yahoo boys, but why question cold cheese when you can just shut up and feed your family? After that, as a side thing, me and my guys used to move shrooms in on a steady. People went crazy for that. We opened a barbershop in VI briefly, but they shut it down when the queues became too long. They said we were doing illegal shit, but really, one of us was a therapist and many men needed somewhere to talk on a low. After that, I used to organize people for VIPs. My friend was a sitting politician's son, so he plugged it. As for how we run things, WizKid don't already talk am. I know bad guys that know real bad guys that know some other guys. We made a low-key app with photos and specifications. Twins, triplets, dark-skinned, mixed race, BBW, gay men, drag queens, lesbians, kinksters, all sorts. All our clients needed to do was tap the screen and a fee would appear. Whoever they chose would be on the next flight in. It's not mouth I'll use to tell you how much money we pulled from that. It's not a small job to guard a tall gate. If you know, you know. But over time it became too heavy because secret yatosi secret kink yatosi kink. And if you know anything about underbellies and darkness, you know their everlastingness. The deeper you go underground, the darker it gets, because the more they trust you with. And you know what? In life, you have to be careful who you allow to trust you. You have to know where to stop before life stops you. Now I run a souvenir shop. I sell fridge magnets from all sorts of countries for people who lie to their partners about traveling abroad for work. If you lie like that, you need supporting gifts. I woke up one day, saw the gap, and did quick maths. We fly things in from all over daily. We have our own duty-free, everything from perfumes to whiskey to Mont Blanc to Swarovski to Creme de la Mer and La Prairie Dim, you name it. Now, it's not just husbands and wives who use us. It's people who lie to their parents about what they do and how much they earn and how much they travel, and dem plenty. We found a guy who's a wizard with Photoshop, hooked him up. Now we have a photography studio to complete the whole deal. We work with low-key hotels, too, for those who need where to hide until the lie expires. Just last week, we sorted out an influencer who wanted to turn her Instagram around but didn't have the funds for it. After she filled the forms, our photographer took the pictures and placed her in multiple locations in all the countries she said she wanted to travel to. From this Lagos here, she was posting photos of herself on the plane, at the airport, in the cities themselves. Our plugs do the legwork and get their cut. In the photo I like the most, the babe is sitting in the rock Zanzibar and there are prawns inside her mouth that she never tasted. In the next grid, her internet self is in Santon Sky with a friend, eating risotto and drinking Sauvignon Blanc at the Codfather. They posted it from 10:04 here. The week after, we dipped her in Insta self in Lock Rose in Senegal. Come and see comments. Her leg is never touched there. The water doesn't know her skin. But who must know? She gained thousands of followers from that move because image. Everything in this life is what? Image. These days, people always talk about getting a seat at the table, putting a foot in the door. Me? I make doors out of thin air. In my life, I've never put on a long-sleeved shirt, lined my own collar with a tie, knotted it, and pulled it up to my neck. I never worn suit in this Lagos heat or carried briefcase to any office, and since I turned 20, not once has landlord knocked on my door for rent. I know I'm lucky, trust me, but when people look down on me for being me, I just know their brains are small. If you think it's only hard work and not smart work that will keep your life together in this country, then you're a fool now. Are you not? You're a fool. We started this thing last year. So far, I've seen over 200 clients, and we don't charge chicken change. Why does it work? Because there's always a market for lies. It's the demand that makes the supply necessary. The other day, somebody asked me what I'll do after this, and I told him I don't know. I always know. I just don't discuss my moves before I move. My next target market is already set. Never forget. Wherever there are people, there are opportunities, and anything can be doctored so far you know who to call doctor. Me and my partner live in a 6-bedroom house in Lekki, except for when we're at our beach house in Alashe. We got this place when he moved from Josie to come and be with me. He's half from there and half from here. When we got tired of the distance, we had to choose. In that his old apartment in Maboning, it all it took was one look at each other, and Kay laughed because he already knew. We didn't even table the question twice. His bags were here a month from then. Between me and Kay, we can afford to live nice on some expat shit because he has never not earned in dollars, and for him, work is a drug. If you step outside our front door, we have two Mercedes Benzes parked in line. Behind the Benzes, a Bentley. Behind the Bentley, a Lexus convertible that was just delivered last month. We bought it together, tear rubber. All this and 30 is not that far behind me. Next is a G-Wag. Kay doesn't know yet. I'm surprising him with it for his 38th, and I know he'll cry. We like cars, both of us, but his own is different. He knows everything about engines and wiring and all. Me, I collect them because I can. In a way, your car is like a second outfit. My wardrobe is full of casual things, but I'm always making statements. Short, memorable statements. Clothes are just one way to tension streets. But a mad whip is a great way to say, don't fuck with me, and hear the streets need to hear that in Pidgin, Yoruba, Igbo, Hausa, plus many other languages. For everyday things, we ride either Benz. Both are tinted with customized plates. Police have not checked our license or car papers in years. To them, our names are chairman, and why wouldn't it be when we're more government than their governor? Here, this one for you, this one for the kids. We keep them happy and they save us stress. For parties where there will be VIPs, we use the Bentley and leave with the right business cards. Me and Kay wear rings, but people don't ask personal questions when they see what you've come out of. We bought that right to go unchallenged. It was not cheap. When I'm going somewhere chilled with Kay, we take the Lexus and drop the top. Still so new, it gives me what they call endorphins. Me and Kay love watching sunsets like that. When he falls into his dark moods, I take him on long drives, and he blasts the music until the mirror starts beating and we can't hear our heads. King of the O, give him two songs, max, and he'll reset us both. I love those drives. Some nights when we're bored after playing FIFA, me and my guys race each other down the Link Bridge at 2 a.m. with some Formula One energy. Whoever loses has to buy the next stash of loud. Sometimes Kay stays home and watches Netflix. Other times he comes with us, and I see how happy he gets with his head outside the window, wind beating against his face. That's an answered prayer right there. Before Kay, I'd never been with a guy who gelled with my friends. Years ago, we couldn't have imagined half the shit we have now, but it's real. To me, the joy of having money is in sharing it. Life of my dreams with the people of my dreams. Even though we all have our places, my closest friends have keys to my house and I have keys to theirs. Sometimes you need a break from your normal. Right from day one, they didn't waste time at all. Rascals, all of them. They claim their room sharp, sharp. Marrow picked the room downstairs that opens into the garden. Aiken likes the guest chalet. You should have seen the rest fighting. It's their house, too, at this point, so they cycle in and out as they like. Some of them drive my cars out on dates. There used to be another car years ago, our first one. But for May's 30th, Kay said we should give her the Hummer. It suits her, and babes love a dyke with a big car. Gives off the right message. Plus, we'd outgrown our love for it, and she was obsessed. Simple maths. Life is about give and take. I tell people all the time. Street's not electric. Anybody fit shock you. So when you find your people, the ones we go ride for you till this world fold, commit to them like it's a religion. We live our lives like it is. Every other Friday, one of us will host games night. We rotate houses. Lagos Island this week, Ikoyi next week, Magodo upper week. We show up unless we can't. Speaking of my guys, I'd put a bullet in anybody for them if it comes to that. We always pray it never comes to it. But check this. Some weeks back, one of them came to my house crying his eyes out. Way over 3 decades into his life. He has seen heartbreak, stabbings, jungle justice that involved fire with a body smoking, and this was the third time I'd ever seen him cry. The wise of the first two will follow me to my grave. But that day I had to hold him until he could breathe again. His father had died, and when he got the news, he said he could feel himself spinning. The last of all of us to become fatherless, he was on the street outside a restaurant where they'd been eating, and his person hugged him after he got the call, held him as he tried not to break down. My guy said he felt so much sadness mixed with fear, mixed with relief, mixed with shame, that instead of relaxing, he scanned the street and pulled out of the hug, but not before thumping his person on the back 3 times. Code for, no homo, bro. Who does that, he wanted to know. No one was even there, just like 2 kids passing. I'm not even that kind of guy. Me and Morrow laughed out loud, then told him the truth. Morrow and I have been friends for 12 years. Before we got free, you know how many times we made someone we love feel crazy in public just to save our own face? It was enough to flood Yaba left. But if you catch it, you can fix it. That's another thing about my life. Without my friends, I'd be dead. Without my friends, I wouldn't have words for things that need names to shift. I wouldn't have ever faced things you need safety to confess. I know what else he was feeling, what he was saying under what he was saying. There's something about losing a dad whose life killed you, you know? There's no way to explain it. You either know the feeling or you don't, you get? You feel like you can finally breathe. At some point, I asked Morrow, who knew his father was one of us, if he thought he'd be himself if his father had not died. He said no. He hated himself for it, so no. And you know what? If my popsy had as much as opened his mouth to say he needed me to correct it, or to say that I could solve his depression by marrying that oofa babe I was seeing, best believe I'd be on baby number 3 with her today. So as free as I am now, I'm only free to date whoever the fuck I like, fuck whoever the hell I want, because he never asked that of me. I could see it. Morrow's father never married, but he had a best friend, who sometimes showed up to the house for weekends. Uncle H had a wife he couldn't stop telling about business trips. Morrow's father would set the table, shave his head in anticipation, and then act surprised at the knock. Many times they cooked dinner from scratch. My friend, go and play with your own friends, Uncle H used to say to Morrow, laughing. Let me catch up with my own. But Morrow has a memory he talks about often, of his father looking at his skinny jeans with disgust and asking him, "Is that what you want to be?" They never talked about it again. He was drunk then. Morrow's story is not as simple as mine. How can it be when there was a noose involved? But I sat there thinking, my God, one less death and my boy would not exist. My guy, my best friend, whose love saved my life, would not exist. You know what I did? I hid behind my teeth and thanked God for it. Terrible, but I thought, we are fatherless boys now, and sure, there are big griefs in us, but at least we get to be us. At least we get to be us. At the end of that conversation, when we got drunk, we sang along to the song Aiken wrote in 5 minutes while we were smoking. Genius man, that one. We sang, if you know where people go when they die, pardon me for assuming you'll reach there before me, before us. Tell our fathers they tried. Tell them they made some good boys, in the end, out of us. We all cried for real then, whether it was the happy or sad kind, till now nobody knows. Last, all of us go, still die. But if we must live, then shay, it's only makes sense to love. At different times we were terrified that we wouldn't find our tribe. We wouldn't find our people who would see us for us because of what we'd been told to hide. But here we are, all flavors of free. One of my guys has a boyfriend and a girlfriend. They live together. They said it's called a thruple. Me, I cannot wrap my head around it. May dates multiple women at once, and they all know. Some of the people she dates even date each other, too. They say that one is polyamory. Me, do I understand it? No. Another one of my friends does not want anything to do with sex. He has never tried it, and he is not moved by it. I can't relate, but I've learned that you don't have to relate to give people the space to be. Me, I'm in love and safe. Imagine? I'm safe. So I confess, too, that I don't think both my father and I could have stayed alive in each other's lives as our individual selves. Someone needed to become something else. So I did. I didn't fully become me until he was gone. I never thought I could voice those words, but you know what I like the most about all of us? Before we met each other, we all had lies we needed to tell ourselves and others if we were going to live well. Morrow says there's already a term for that type of lie, necessary fictions. Looking at each other and saying, this is my own lie, this is my own truth. No, that other part was a mask, this part here is my face. It's a survival thing. If you know this country, then you know not to walk maskless. But let me tell you something, this love shit is holy. When it's pure and patient, the thing just bends your knees. It's scary. I shook so much the first time Mauro told me he loved me. I didn't even know friends could say that without it turning into something else. So I thought he wanted something, and I tried to reply with my body, just out of reflex, out of gratitude. He saw where I was going, stopped me, and said, "It's me." I remember that moment clearly. It was one tear at a time until I couldn't stop. He didn't run. He held me. When you meet real care, it changes you. It remakes you as you. It lets you take a deep breath. It turns your friend into your brother. It took me time, but I say it back to all of them now. Anyway, you want to know what I said when I was at work one day and got a call to come back home because my father was sick. After years of not hearing from him, I said yes, and I stayed there for 2 months. I took care of him and paid all the hospital bills. When he got well enough to say hello to me, my father followed the greeting with a request. "You're doing well for yourself," he said, "and my life is going. There's only one more thing remaining. Won't you let me meet the woman you will marry? Won't you let me see you whole?" Now, the difference between Mauro's story and my own is that my father looked at me, even knowing I owed him nothing, and he still asked that of me. I held his hand, my heart capsizing slowly, and said, "Yes, sir, you will see me whole." "When?" he asked. "Tomorrow, just here," I said. For the anxiety that request dragged out of me, I planned to walk out of there and never return. Still, I said, "If you're ready, then I'm ready. Tomorrow." "Good," he said, and closed his eyes. He believed he needed to bless my heart for love to work for me. Imagine that. A man I lived without for over a decade. A man who didn't know if I still had a beating heart wanted to meet the person I would love enough to start a life with. I went home and cried on Kay's shoulder. It was both of us who pooled resources together to do what we could for my dad. For months, Kay had been dipping his hand into his pocket for the man who almost made us impossible, the man who would hate him on sight. It was somewhere in that breakdown that I changed my mind. The next day, I took Kay to my father's bedside. My person stood by me, watching us. "Where is she?" my father asked, ignoring the obvious. I stared back at my response, no words involved, just eye to eye, man to man. I saw it click. He swallowed and then he opened his mouth to talk. Nothing came out. I repeated myself with a closed mouth, hands in my pockets, staring him down. I felt Kay turn to stone in fear. The money we both spent bullied my father in front of me, its knuckles ready for his teeth. "Do you understand?" the money asked him. He shrank, and I almost pitied him. I reached for Kay's hand, and feeling how much it had been sweating, I lifted his hand to my mouth and pressed my lips to it before holding his palm to my chest. "Are you sure you understand, Dad?" I asked. By then, my voice was hot iron. "No one," I decided there and then, "is allowed to kill me twice." Using my child voice, he said, "Yes, sir." And using his dad voice, I said, "Good boy." And that story was Good Boy by Elogosa Osunda from the Best American Short Stories from the year 2021, edited by Jesmyn Ward. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from the same book, Hagalori by Stephanie Swallow. When Hagalori woke at 4:30 and went to the kitchen in his shorts and slippers, Dot was already there at the table, tanked up on coffee. He poured himself a cup without much looking at his wife. Outside the kitchen window, his tomatoes blushed in the moonlight. The blue crabs down in the Sabine marshes would have been gorging all night under that bright full moon, and this morning Hagalori planned to catch some. He fixed his coffee and pretended there was nothing strange about Dot sitting up before dawn, when she was usually in bed until 9 or 10. Her joints kept her awake late, and on top of that, she'd get herself all agitated watching the nightly news or reading the paper. How she could stand it, he didn't know. It was always the same thing. New Orleans this, Katrina that. Like those people were the only ones who'd been hit by a storm. In the wee hours, she would finally bump down the hall to sleep in the extra room, the one that used to be for the kids, and wake Hagalori on the way, dropping her dishes in the sink, closing doors harder than she needed to. Lord, did she make some racket moving around the house. Then she'd stay in that room with the door shut until long after sunrise. Maybe she was sleeping, or maybe she was sick of his face. He was sick of hers, too, most days. Never mind, though. At least Hagalori could, in the quiet solitude, wholly inhabit the kitchen. Coffee pot, preserves, dainty demitasse cups, and silverware dot saved for company. He played house in the morning dark. He even cleaned up after himself. But it was different with her sitting there. He had learned, in his 5 years of retirement, that if he helped with housework, she yelled, whereas if he left a trail of dirt and crumbs as he went about his day, she rewarded him with a petulant silence. So now he spilled some sugar on the counter, stirred and sloshed coffee out of the cup, then left the spoon on top of the pot. For good measure, he swept the spilled sugar to the floor. She spoke anyway. "I'm going with you this morning. I done put some cokes in the cooler, and I had my bath. Go get your clothes on." "Ty don't come in till 9," he lied. "I want to see how things are down there. About the same as last time. No point looking at it again." "How could it be the same? That was months ago." She grabbed hold of the table's edge, rocked a couple of times, and pulled herself creaking and popping out of the chair. "Let's beat the crowd," she said. "We don't got to go now." But she was already out the door. This early the August day was an oven set to warm. By mid-morning they'd be back up to broil, and Dot would be spitting mean as a cat with its tail on fire. Hagalori stalled in the garden, picking a few nearly ripe tomatoes and unloading a vine of dewy string beans. The lawn beyond was littered with wilted leaves and pecans, still in their green husks, all fallen into his yard from the neighbor's tree just across the property line. He gathered the nuts in a flap of untucked shirt. The moon, hanging in the dark sky, shone through the bare branches. It was dying, that tree, no question. Well, good. For all old Mathern had to know, the storm could have done that. Hagalori's own trees hadn't been the same since Rita hit last year. They were gaunt and crooked. There was sun in the yard where there used to be shade. One of the oaks had dropped its thickest limb through his roof right over the living room. When he and Dot had come home, almost a week after the storm, he found his favorite chair soaked and growing black paisleys of mildew. It had to be put to the street along with the end table he'd built, and the TV remote control, and his fishing magazines, and his lamp, and the vibrating pad for his back. All ruined. On his way to the garage, Hagalori dumped the pecans noisily into the garbage can. Then he loaded the nets, twine, cooler, tackle box, fishing rod, and a couple of lawn chairs into the bed of the truck. Dot in the cab had twisted her head around to watch him. She was saying something through the glass. When he opened the driver's door, she said, "I was trying to tell you to grab me a hat." He slunk his hand behind the bench seat and pulled out the lopsided, sweat-stained straw contraption that their son Danny used to wear when Hagalori took him fishing, just the two of them, father and son. But they didn't do that anymore. His son didn't come around much at all, not since Hagalori spoke his mind about that child Danny and his wife adopted 2 years ago out of some country he'd never heard of. They already had a kid of their own. Why did they need another one? The hat was dry-rotted and raveling at the rim and too big for Dot's head, but she had the good sense to keep her mouth shut about it. He had planned to pick up a package of melt at the grocery around the corner before heading south into the marsh, but after parking outside the store, he saw that it didn't open until 6. "May, I could have told you that," Dot said. "We can stop in Hackberry. They won't have melt." "What you think? Sulphur's the only town with melt? They have melt in Hackberry. I don't know if that store is still standing." "It is. It was on the news." "Her in the news." In the truck cab, they were as close as they had been, physically speaking, in a very long time. They did not sleep in the same bed anymore. They did not eat together at the same table. They did not visit the same friends. Or rather, Dot visited the same friends, and Hagalori visited no one at all. She'd been especially prickly after that week of evacuation last fall at Danny's house up in DeRidder. Well, that hadn't been fun for anyone. Air mattresses on the floor, fighting for the television, or, when the power went out, for the lanterns and battery-powered fans, or, days later, for the better MREs. Their daughter, Carol, with that good-for-nothing boyfriend of hers, sharing a mattress in front of everybody. And the adopted child, not quite bright, with her foreign lisp and feline eyes. She was about 10, just a few years older than Danny's natural son, and you could see the little boy tense up whenever she got too close, like a dog expecting a kick. There was that screaming fit she'd thrown with a fork in her hand when she got the ham slice MRE instead of the chili and macaroni. Hagalori said, so she could hear, that they ought to send her back to where she came from, if it was so bad here. The girl had to learn. Dot hadn't liked that at all. But what? Did she think he had fun saying that kind of truth? Now here they were, in the truck, with nothing to listen to but AM radio and each other coughing, snuffling, and throat-clearing. Between Lake Charles and Hackberry they spoke only once, about a quarter of an hour into the drive. With the light coming up, they could see a storm building in the west and a few vanguard clouds above. From time to time, the sky spat on their windshield. They drove by a pasture that held a herd of red cows. "Look at them cows," Hagalori said. "They all in a clump. Gonna get some rain today." Dot clucked her tongue. "Them cows are scattered." "Ah," said Hagalori. The Hackberry store was indeed standing, although a third of its roof was draped in blue plastic. Across the street, a house that had been neatly halved by a fallen oak tree was fronted by a FEMA trailer. The pasture beside the store had been turned into an appliance graveyard, filled with row upon row of taped-up refrigerators and freezers, ruined washers, dryers, and stoves. A fridge on the outer row said, in red spray-painted letters, "Do not open. Insurance adjuster inside." Hagalori laughed. The store, which was the last stop before you got to the oil reserve, was busy, even this early, with young men in their industrial blues getting fried chicken and pizza slices from the hot bar for their lunch. Dot waddled along beside Hagalori, then stopped, picked up a package of boudin on sale, and took out her glasses to read the label. He didn't wait for her. Behind the meat counter, a sleepy teenager was wrapping up a pound of shrimp for an old man in sagging khaki overalls and cap. When it came to his turn, Hagalori tapped the glass and asked the boy how much the night crawlers were. "What we need night crawlers for," Dot said, pulling up next to him. "We don't need no night crawlers." "If I want to fish," Hagalori snapped, "how much you asking for them?" "$2," the boy said. "Shoo! $2 for some worms?" The teenager said nothing. Hagalori hovered for a while, then finally slid the glass back and reached down to pluck one of the little styrofoam boxes from the stack. He opened the lid and peered into the dirt. A thick pink segment of worm throbbed on the surface. "You're just looking to lamentation," Dot said. "How many they got in here?" Hagalori asked. "I don't know. A bunch." The teenager looked around for another customer. 2 pounds of melt," Dot said, stepping past her husband. "No melt today." "Ah," said Hagalori. "We'll get us some chicken necks instead," Dot said. "You think the crabs don't know the difference?" "The crabs don't know the difference." It was almost full daylight when Hagalori and Dot at last got themselves established in the lawn chairs on the footbridge that crossed the canal. From each of 4 pilings they dangled a chicken neck on a length of twine. The marsh grass shivered in a little bit of breeze. Dense iron-blue clouds were mustering to the west, but they had a few good hours before the storm would break here. The truck was parked nearby, on the highway median, and they could get to it fast. Every few minutes, Hagalori, restless, would rise from his chair and take one of the lines in hand, ever so gently easing the bait up from the depths of the brackish water until it appeared just below the surface. If he felt a tug or spied a dogged claw, he'd say, "Pass me that net! Quick, quick!" But Dot was seldom quick. Sometimes she was distracted, fussing in her purse for a hanky or for aspirin, which she was taking in handfuls, or for whatever else was knocking around in that apparently bottomless sack. But when she was quick, she was too quick, and her passing shadow would send the crab skittering back into the murk. "What, you never caught a crab before?" he said. They had been out there a little more than 2 hours and had netted exactly 5 crabs when another car pulled in behind their truck. Before the brake lights had even gone off, a woman threw open the passenger door and charged down the gravel shoulder toward the footbridge, shaking her head and mouthing what could only be curses. 2 boys, maybe 8 and 10, emerged, sheepish, from the back seat and trailed after her. The smaller one wore a huge T-shirt that swallowed his shoulders and reached to his knees. They were all of them in white rubber shrimping boots, many sizes too big. The driver killed the motor and opened his door. He leaned against the car, resting his crossed arms on the roof and looking after the woman and the boys. A baseball cap cut a shadow across his eyes and cheeks. The woman stopped suddenly, turned around. She flung her arms over her head and dropped them to her sides. "Are you sure this is where?" she yelled back at the man. The man half nodded, half shrugged, and a frustrated growl came from the woman's chest. She set off again for the bridge. "Perkins!" she called out. "Mr. Perks!" The boys started too, a chirping chorus of, "Perkins! Perkins!" The older one louder and more zealous. "Lord have mercy," Hagalori said. Dot reached into the cooler, past the clattering crabs, for an RC Cola and a root beer. "Here," she said, "drink your root beer." She took off her shoes and wriggled her toes. She was red-faced and sweating. The church bulletin she folded into a fan wasn't doing her much good. The woman was now before them. The two boys clumped up in their big white boots and hung onto the railing, one casting his eyes out across the marsh and the other down into the water. "Y'all seen a cat around here?" the woman said. She looked like a shriveled little monkey, Hagalori thought, with a sharp little monkey face and angry, clasping monkey hands. Her bristly peroxide hair stood up straight and square like a fez. "We ain't seen no cat out here," Hagalori said. "What does it look like?" Dot asked. "That son of a bitch back there," the woman said, jerking her head back toward the car in the median, and the younger boy's shoulders hunched up to his ears. That son of a bitch, presumably the boy's father, was now mounting the bridge, hands in pockets, toothpick in teeth. "Any luck?" he said, looking at no one, and he could have meant the crabs or the cat. "He don't have any claws," the woman said, and stalked off over the bridge and into the grass. "Perkins!" she yelled. The older boy followed her, and the younger one hung back, still gazing down into the water. Their father leaned against the bridge railing next to him. Behind him, the woman and the older boy were fanning out into the marsh in lurching, sloshing steps, parting the cord grass with their hands as they went and calling the cat. "Y'all catching any?" the man said. "Just enough to make you mad," Hagalori said. "Really?" the man said. "I'm surprised. The crab's been going nuts since the storm knocked out those flood weirs. Still pretty high salt, even into Sweet Lake." "It ain't for lack of crabs," Hagalori said. Dot cut him a pair of eyes, and he took up his fishing rod. He opened the container he'd bought at the store and tugged a nightcrawler out of the dirt. He pinched it in two, tossed half back in, and threaded the other half onto the hook. About 3 feet up the line, he attached a plastic cork, then wiped his gooey fingers on his coveralls. He scooted his chair closer to the water and dropped the line in. He'd see what else was there to be caught. "May what?" Dot said to the man. "You dumped her cat in the marsh?" "He kept peeing on my bunk," the younger one said quietly, then squatted, stretched the t-shirt over his knees, and tucked it under the toes of his boots. He pulled on one of the crab lines, hand over hand, as slowly as if he were creeping up on a rabbit. After a while, he reached out an arm, fluttered his fingers. "There's a big one on here. Give me the net. I'll pull it in for you." But nobody gave him the net. "There it goes," he said, sighing. "Y'all can't imagine what it's like," the boy's father said. "Three adults, two kids, and an incontinent cat. In a 10-by-30-foot box? Nobody can live like that. It's been almost a year." He stripped off his hat and beat it against his thigh. "C'est un bon grand, that Fema," Hagalori said. He spat into the canal. This young fella and his family, that little boy with his shirt too big, they'd never show that on the news. It was sad how they forgot about some people, not about others. He himself was still waiting on payment for the damage Rita had done to his roof. "I'm sick to death of Katrina," he said. "You don't hear about nothing else." He was fixing to say more about all the people in this world, like those looters in flooded New Orleans or that little adopted girl at Danny's who seemed to think their suffering entitled them to inflict suffering on others, when the cork on his fishing line dipped below the surface. He jerked the rod to the right, stood up from his chair, and began reeling in the line, the tip of the rod arching and quivering with the weight of whatever was down there, tugging. What was down there was a little garfish about a foot and a half long, maybe 2 pounds. Hagalori grabbed it behind the gills. "Reach me those pliers," he said to Dot, and she did. "Young man," he said, "you know what that is?" The boy came closer, eyed the fish. "That's a gar." "That's one ugly fish," Hagalori said, and he felt the ugliness in a frisson down his spine. The eel-like body, the long jaws opening and closing, the needle teeth and staring eyes, the blood pooling around the hook in its cheek. He yanked out the bare hook. Then he wrapped the pliers around the base of the gar's snout. Those night crawlers didn't come cheap. "Watch what I do with that fish," he said, and he squeezed until, with a crunch, the snout snapped off and fell to the planks at his feet. The little fish thrashed in his hand, working what was left of its jaw. Hagalori leaned over the railing and dropped the fish back into the water. He wiped his hand on his coveralls and sat. "Now," he said to the boy, "you see?" "Yes, sir," the boy said, and looked up at his father. "Those are trash fish," the man said. He jammed his hat backward onto the boy's head and gave the brim a little tug. "I never could eat those myself." Dot made that noise with her tongue. "Ta parente," she said. She got up wobbly and crossed the bridge, following the path to the marsh. Out there in the grass, the woman was shouting something at the oldest boy. Dot reached the end of the path, held out one arm for balance, and tested the mucky ground with her foot. "You're going to fall over if you try that," Hagalori said, but she didn't listen. "Fine, let her break a hip." Was it his fault the gar was an ugly fish? He lifted his tackle box onto his lap and dug around until he found a multi-tool that he'd won as a door prize at one of the gumbo luncheons the painters' union put on. It had pliers, a screwdriver, a knife, a toothpick. A good little tool. He never used it. He held it out to the boy. "You want that?" The boy shrugged. "Sure," he said, and took it. The tool disappeared under his T-shirt. "Tell the man thank you," the boy's father said. "Thank you." "I'm sorry for y'all," Hagalori said. The sky had gone dark in the time since his family had arrived, the storm nearly upon them. To the west, a single stunning bolt of lightning touched the marsh, chased by a whip-crack of thunder. The boy ducked and cringed like a little animal, then glanced at his father and smiled, embarrassed. "We better get going," the man said. He called out to the woman and the older boy, but they were already coming back. Dot was talking with the woman, who was moving her hands, excited. She pointed back toward Hackberry and the direction from which they had come, then swung her finger around to the man on the bridge and jabbed the air. Dot wagged her head violently and talked for a while, too, pointing occasionally at Hagalori. The older boy reached the bridge first. "Well," the man said, and the boy said nothing. He bumped the shoulder of the younger one as he passed. Then came Dot and the woman. The woman scooped the younger boy to her side, held him against her hip. "We'll come back tomorrow," she said, and eyed a second flash of lightning. The deep hum of thunder buzzed in Hagalori's chest. "It's been a week," the man said. "That cat is probably long gone." "Maybe if you'd said something earlier," the woman said, "instead of letting us think he ran away. And after all that..." It looked to Hagalori like she was going to cry over a cat. "Y'all have no idea what we went through to keep that cat with us." "Oh, share," Dot said. "I'm going to leave you my phone number," the woman said. She patted herself down like she might actually have a pen and paper stashed in those cutoffs. "Y'all have something to write with?" "Just tell me the number," Hagalori said. "I'll remember." "He won't remember. Here, I've got a pen in my purse." Dot dug in her purse forever. Once the woman had the pen, there was the problem of something to write on. But Dot held out her palm. "Write it here." The woman wrote the number and called out to the cat a few more times before turning abruptly away. "Y'all stay dry," the man said. The boy in the big T-shirt gave Hagalori a quick down-at-the-hip wave. His older brother was already waiting at the car, staring down the highway, arms stiff at his sides, hands clenched into fists, like he was trying to see clear to the gulf. The man went to him, laid a palm on the nape of his neck, steered him gently into the back seat, and shut the door. They all settled in and drove away. "Over a cat," Hagalori said, and started to gather their things. He cut the crab lines off the pilings and let the loose ends of twine slide into the canal. He secured the fish hook to a guide and reeled the line in tight, then folded the chairs and propped them and the net and the rod against the cooler. A fat drop of rain tapped his arm, another one his neck. Dot just stood there watching. Hagalori knelt and closed his tackle box. "You think I don't know what you did to Mathern's tree?" Dot said. He pressed tight the lid on the container of worms. What tree? That pecan tree. You think I don't know? The storm killed that tree. Or to the Landry's dog? Ah. She raised a finger in the air. The next time Carol calls, you're not going to hang up. You're going to talk. And if somebody tells you that somebody died, you know what you're going to say? You're going to tell them, I'm sorry to hear that. You're not going to say, meh, so? And, she said, shaking so hard her cheeks jiggled, you're going to quit calling Zarina that girl Danny adopted. She's your granddaughter. You just call her my granddaughter from now on, you hear me? I don't have to do nothing, Hagalori said. He looked down at Dot's bare feet, her legs muddy to the calves. He wanted to say, you going to get in my truck like that? But it wasn't worth it. You're a spiteful man, and why? She said. A la tête dure, yeah. I should have known that from the beginning. That part was true, he thought. She should have. From the very first time they met at the dance hall in Basel, when he told her, just for the hell of it, that his name was Herman, and for months, even after things had gone past dancing, she had called him Herman, and all his friends had gone along with it, snickering behind her back, until one day she asked a visiting cousin, "Where's Herman?" And he said, "Who?" And she said, "Herman." He was just standing right here, and he said, "There isn't any Herman. You must mean Hagalori." And the jig was finally up. She should have known then. Fair warning. But she had married him anyhow. "I've had just about enough," she said. She picked up her shoes and nothing else and turned toward the truck, flapping one hand at her side like she was shaking off a punch. Inside the cooler, the crabs rattled around. When Hagalori opened the lid, three of them lifted their claws, furious, cursing God. Five crabs weren't even enough to bother with. He dumped them out on the bridge and kicked them one by one over the edge into the water. He carried the cooler and the rod and the chairs to the truck. Dot was sitting in the cab, staring past the beads of rain sliding down the windshield, as if searching for something far down the road, the same way the boy had done. Well, what did they think they would find? He snuck up to her window and tapped on the glass to see if he could scare her. She didn't flinch. When he went back to collect his tackle box and the last odds and ends from the bridge, he said, "Well, I'll be damned." There was the cat. It crouched in the gravel path and mewled. Hagalori wiped the rain from his forehead and arms. He bent over and wriggled his fingers. "Come here, you," he said. The cat hesitated, meowed, tense as if it was about to dart off into the marsh, then lifted its tail in the air and came to Hagalori. It shoved its cheek against his shin. He cast a glance over his shoulder at the truck. Dot was leaning across the seat, reaching for the key, which he'd left in the ignition. She started the engine, adjusted the air conditioning vents, and rested her head against the window, eyes closed. Hagalori slipped a hand under the cat's belly and lifted it, held it against his chest. It was light and limp, purring in deep, relieved breaths. All down its sides, the fur was matted in clumps, and at the base of its tail was a solid, tangled carpet of hair and grass and shit. It smelled disgusting. "You need a bath, you," Hagalori said. The rain was seeping through his clothes and through the cat's fur. Its thick ruff seemed to melt away. Underneath was a skinny little neck. Hagalori smoothed his hand over the cat's forehead, flattened its ears back, and held them. "You had to pee on that little boy's bed," he said. Its big eyes stared, yellow and bright. He felt sorry for it. He really did. But in the end, it was just a cat, wasn't it? He wrapped his fingers around a paw and pressed on the soft pads to spread the impotent toes. Then, as smooth and easy as he would throw a fishing line, Hagalori tossed out his arms and flung the cat, pinwheeling over the rail and into the canal, thinking as it splashed, "We'll see how spiteful I am," thinking, "There's all kind of meanness and all kinds of mercy, too." And that story was Hagalori by Stephanie Swallow from the Best American Short Stories from the year 2021, edited by Jesmyn Ward. And now from Pushcart Prize, Volume 37, from the year 2013, edited by Bill Henderson. From Your Hostess at the T&A Museum by Kathleen Balma. If you will not tip me for my dance, tip me for daring to ask. Or if, having stared at me directly for the duration of a song or two, you still did not manage to see me, as you claim, then tip me for what you see now, the perfect circumference of twin areola, one torso a la Aphrodite statue, one triangle of cloth bundling the origin of the world and pointing like an arrow to the masculine earth. Do you doubt that the artist tipped his model? Ah, but you're right. There is that old understanding between painters and nudes. Tit for dab, so to speak. Similarly, artists and restaurateurs have sometimes exchanged a mouthful for an eye feast. Dab for tidbit, slapdash for tiddlywink. Tip me, then, in calories. Offer me a slice of lime split wide over the edge of a beverage. Tip me for staring back so hard it puts even Olympia to shame and makes her Chat Noir slink ever closer to her overlooked and under-rendered black maid. Tip me at least for carrying so many geometricians' tools, the circle, the triangle, the rectangular bills tucked beneath such finite, immeasurable bikini lines. Tip me for my burlesque, crescent-shaped ass. Tip me for what you don't see, the abstract, the invisible, the squiggly outline of a model's brain matter and silhouette. The negative space plastered between fleshy objects like some happy vacuum, giving form to the nothingness between us. And that was from your hostess at the TNA Museum by Kathleen Balma from Pushcart Prize Volume 37 from the year 2013, edited by Bill Henderson. And that's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. If you miss a program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can also listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me, and bye for now.